Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
I am the leader of the Cornerstone series and got my experience. And I'm also former Navy, Navy Intel. So that's what brought me to DEF more specifically. So let me introduce our two speakers, Jeremy Bauman and Peter Dolch. Jeremy Bauman is the managing director of the New Dominion Angels, which is a mid-Atlantic angel group. So they do a lot of investing in this area in early stage companies. He's also on the emerging states finance team at the World Bank. So not only does he do this mid-Atlantically, but he does it globally. And also we have Peter Dolch, who's a two-time Inc. 500 founder, and he's a member of the MIT Angels, Alumni Angels, and New York Angels, which are very well-respected angel groups. A lot of expertise in operations, fundraising, software development, other areas of relevant for emerging companies. And he's also a member of something called GRIP, Platform for Emerging Companies of Venture Capital, with multidisciplinary forms. So I'll first turn it over to Peter to start. He has slides to go through, and then we'll talk to Jeremy. He'll give his presentation, and then we'll do Q&A since we have so many people on the call.
So thanks, Jed, for inviting me to this. And Jeremy, it's great to meet you as well. Kind of psyched to be co-presenting with you. Before I get started, just to let everyone know, this is a brand new presentation I'm working from. Jeremy and I are going to be talking about the two sides of the coin of angel investing. I will talk a bit more from the entrepreneur side, and Jeremy is going to talk a bit more from the angel investing side. Just to give you my background, I went to MIT a long time ago. You guys can see my gray hair. But not only do I have the geek cred, but I was also the managing partner of my firm. So I have the operational strategy, sales experience. Before I started my company, I was involved with two early tech consulting startups that both had big exits. My consulting firm was in Inc. 500 twice, as Jed mentioned. Not only did I lead numerous global enterprise engagements for companies like Pfizer, Hewlett Packard, American Stock Exchange, Viacom, we built the first three generations of B&H's e-commerce infrastructure way back in the dot-com heyday. But I've also been involved in my technology consulting practice in helping 30 to 40 startups get launched. So that gave me a lot of insight into the journey of entrepreneurs. Because when they come to you early, you're just not getting involved in technology as a consultant. You're also getting involved in strategy, sales. It's very iterative. We had one company come to us years ago with an idea on a napkin, literally an idea written on a napkin, and we helped them all the way through to their IPO. And we had another company come to us with an idea, and we decided to incubate them, and they worked at our offices, and we helped them with technology, fundraising, and saw them through to about a $35 million exit 6 years later. So those were great experiences. I parlayed that into a $1 million angel fund that I ran for several years. As Jed mentioned, I'm a member of several angel groups. 3 years ago, I founded a Swiss-based medtech startup called BioSpectral. That's another interesting journey where we won gold at Mass Challenge, we raised $1 million, we won a prestigious Gates Foundation grant, and we signed a first ever of its kind contract with the World Health Organization. So I have some background on the entrepreneurial space, the fundraising space, and theoretically I know a little bit about this. And I think my big superpower when it comes to working with early stage startups is helping with narrative, pitch deck, fundraising strategy, with a subspecialty in helping talk entrepreneurs down off the ledge. So quick overview on what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to reveal in this presentation for the first time online the most important thing that entrepreneurs don't know. And I'll reveal that early. So if you have to leave early, don't worry, you're going to get to it. And then just some of the standard things around deal terms, creating a narrative, developing a deck, things you've probably read online, but you'll get my special take on those. So what are the key concepts that I'm going to want to get across? I think the key concept that you have to think about when you're raising money is that there's a bit of a zero-sum game. It's two sides of the same coin. And I'm going to talk over and over again about how becoming a good entrepreneur and good fundraising entrepreneur also means understanding a lot about the fundraising side of the game. Deal terms that are good for one side may be bad for the other side. If you can think like an investor and know what they want to hear, then you can tell them what they want to hear. And then when all these things are aligned and in balance, everybody wins. Another important concept that you need to understand as you go through this process is the difference between professional investors and unprofessional investors. It plays a fairly big role, especially in the early stage, because professional investors look at deals very differently than unprofessional investors do. And often the very first money comes in from unprofessional investors. Those might be your Uncle Joe. It might be someone who you work with at school, a professor, could be a managing director at Morgan Stanley if you had a background in fintech. These people are not experts at valuing deals. They're not an expert at deal terms. But what they do is they validate everything you've done up until that moment. And their validation isn't worth very much. So it's very important to keep in mind what audience you're talking to and what any potential validation means or doesn't mean in those two audiences. Just so we're clear, when we're talking about angel investing, for me, I'm thinking of everything from friends and family through pre-seed to seed to bridge to A. Angels do invest in A and B rounds, but typically only via pro rata rights they got in an earlier round. You're not often pitching novelty to early stage investors when you're in A and B. And then I like to have entrepreneurs I work with think about the fundraising world as a marketplace. Investors looking to buy into good opportunities, and you're looking to sell your opportunity to investors. The key thing to remember as an entrepreneur is that there's a lot of product out there. As a member of a couple of angel groups, we see thousands of deals in a given month cross through the very, very different funnels that we work with. So you really do need to stand out. You shouldn't have an expectation of an investment. And then I think one very important thing that I tell every entrepreneur I work with is take everything I say with a grain of salt. If you talk to five different advisors, you're going to get five different opinions. And my opinion isn't coming from any kind of oracle on high. It's just what I've seen in the world of entrepreneurship and investing. So the first question that you need to ask before you go down the path is, should you be raising venture capital? And it seems like an obvious question, but you have to think about, is there an opportunity to grow organically? The alternative is that you're going to have 5, 10, or 20 business partners. And there's definitely a category of angel that likes to stay deeply involved, ask you how you're doing, stay on top of their investment. You're going to have to be answering to some potentially very annoying people if you go down the path of raising money. So it's something to consider. There are obviously fields like medtech, the energy sector, that require intensive capital. And so you'll have no choice but to raise. But outside of those kinds of sectors, you can go for a long time off of friends and family, credit cards and things before doing an official raise. There's also non-dilutive financing. You can go after DoD grants if they're equitable, NIH grants. We've seen companies get to their first round of angel funding with over $1 million in non-dilutive funding. So if those are areas you can work towards, strongly recommend going after those before you try to raise outside capital. And then there's a problem called fundraising fatigue. Once you start fundraising, you will be fundraising for the rest of your entrepreneurial journey. It's not that obvious and it's not talked about. And I've seen entrepreneurs get into fundraising fatigue cycles where they desperately need money, they're having trouble closing a round, something didn't go right, and they pitch after pitch after pitch. And the whole time they're pitching, they're not focused on running their business. And eventually some deal shows up, which is a terrible deal, and they just have to take it so they can get on with running their business. So that's a risk you run when you go down this path. The other non-obvious risk is that once you go down the fundraising path, there's always going to be a specific date on your P&L at which you're going to run out of money. Because by definition, if you're starting to raise angel capital and moving through the seed and pre-seed rounds, you have a P&L in which you're spending a lot more money than you're bringing in. And there's a point at which you're going to have negative cash. It's very different than when you're running lean and mean prior to raising money. I think something that Jed could probably speak to, if he were advising you, you have a fiduciary obligation to your investors. And it's something, if you're not aware of what those are, you need to look up and understand how you're going to manage that. Another thing I tell entrepreneurs with whom I work is that the standard fundraising narrative is a lie, with an eventual exit for hundreds of millions of dollars. And the reality is, first of all, is I think everyone knows most startups go out of business. And even the ones that can move along for a long period of time, that narrative is quite rare. Fundraising is very hard. It takes a lot of time. The average case is struggling from unfilled round to unfilled round. By way of example, here's the classic narrative. This never happens. An online insurance company called Waffle. I saw them pitch at the MIT Delta V pitch event in 2018. They had a great narrative, super team, disintermediating the insurance industry. Everybody likes disintermediating the insurance industry. InsurTech is super hot. I was excited about the potential investment. I started talking to other investors who were in the room. 3 weeks later, I saw them present at the MIT Enterprise Forum. They closed the round. It was massively oversubscribed. They raised millions of dollars. Now, that story is the story that gets written about. That's like one in 200, one in 400 stories. So I think it's important not to be deceived. Even the hype around accelerators and incubators, the majority of the cohorts aren't the ones that raise money easily. Top of the cohorts in these accelerators and incubators that get all the press. So now we're going to get to the secret sauce, the answer that's never been revealed. And it's the question of what are you selling to your investors? If you know the answer to this question, a much easier time with fundraising. I ask this question to every entrepreneur whom I advise, meet, or work with. I have never yet gotten the answer I was looking for. I'm going to give everyone here a few seconds to think about what the answer might be to what are you selling to your potential investors. You're not selling them your products and services. You're not selling them your great idea. They may invest in you because they like you, but that's not what you're selling them. Okay, here's the big reveal. Selling an exit. An exit is the only way investors make money. I mean, there's a couple of other theoretical ways, but primarily that's what they're looking for. And everything you do in your narrative, in your pitch, in your communication, has to be leading the investors to the idea and to the understanding that this is all going to end with an exit in which they're going to make a lot of money. It's not even about selling them the idea that they'll make a lot of money. That's not quite connecting all the dots. You have to connect the dots in your narrative all the way to an exit. So as part of the process of raising money, there are some things I recommend. You need to build a diverse team. First of all, diverse teams can get you a lot more money and make you more successful. There's really nothing worse than in 2020 going to a pitch event and seeing a presentation in which there's five guys that started a company. It just looks like you guys crawled out of some Neanderthal cave. Also blocks you out of numerous avenues of investing. There's tons and tons of female focused funds. Many of them, you just need to have one female on the cap table with 5% interest. And you can talk to Golden Seeds, Valor Ventures, Female Founders Alliance. You need to find a diverse team. You also need to build a great team. Investors are investing in you. Blown away by the team, they're going to move on. It's the number one thing that smart investors are looking for. I've spoken with the managing directors of numerous accelerators, including ones here in New York City. And when they're investing their own money in startups, their number one metric is the team and nothing else. I always recommend that entrepreneurs raise friends and family money. Not unusual for someone to say, well, I don't have a rich Uncle Joe. I don't come from a wealthy background. Friends and family money creates credibility. If you can't get an ex-colleague, some aunt or uncle, your parents, someone you work with to write you a 10K check, you're not going to get a complete stranger to write you a 10K check or 25K check. You need to create that credibility if you can. I always recommend people, entrepreneurs, get a great advisor. It's unlikely you're going to have every C-level skill and contact necessary to be successful. Provide complementary skills and a network. You need to read up on not just raising money, but on investing as well. As I said earlier, it's both sides of a coin. Understanding how investors think will help you craft a better deal, a better message. Myself, you should take everything you read out there with a grain of salt as well. There's conflicting points of view. The top 10 list of things to have in your deck differs from every VC to every VC. Something that's not obvious that I have to point out to a lot of entrepreneurs, which is you need to raise before you get too close to your launch. The early stages of investing is prior to launch, investors are investing in you. After launch, they're investing in your performance. However, as you get closer and closer to the launch of your business or your product, you're getting closer and closer to the point at which all the risk of the product market fit is being taken off the table. So if you come to me as an investor and say, hey, we're launching in a month or we're launching in 2 months and we need to raise an angel round, why would I give you the money now when all the risk is on the table? I'm going to tell you, well, come back in 2 months and let me know how the launch went. Because if the launch goes badly, I wouldn't want to invest it in you right now. I refer to this often as the uncanny valley of investing. We had an entrepreneur on the West Coast come to myself and some West Coast investors that I know. And we've been talking to him about trying to raise. He said, no, I'm not ready. I want to complete the prototype. Then I want to complete the beta. And then he was a month and a half away from launching and he was running out of money. And he couldn't get anyone to give him money. They all wanted to have him wait until after the launch. So don't wait too long. And then the big piece of advice I think you get everywhere is to download a management tool and track everything you're doing when it comes to interacting with potential investors. Fielding, who was a managing director of New York Tech Stars, she has a great starter spreadsheet for this, which you can download. In general, read her blog. She's great at this kind of stuff. To devote an entire slide to talking about the consequences of a beta, I'll give you one concrete example why you need to think about this very carefully. At New York Angels, we often see entrepreneurs come to us who have done a beta, actually sunk their chances of getting an investment. So I'll give you one concrete example. We saw a super talented entrepreneur, tremendous publishing experience, amazing board of advisors, senior people at Condé Nast, Washington Post, cool technology. He had a very intriguing idea about monetizing content in a novel way. And the amazing thing, which we had never seen before, was that he already developed major partnership with publishing sites and had access to over 40 million unique page views. And they had just spent $800,000 developing their software and running their beta. And they were able to get their widget, which they were successfully put on all these content sites, downloaded by thousands upon thousands of users. And so we raised our hands in the due diligence session, said, great, what did you charge? They didn't charge anything. They gave away for free. They wanted to see if people would download the widget. They wasted opportunity and they didn't get their investment. They had this opportunity to prove that people would pay even a small amount for what they were selling, but they were afraid that the metric would be too small. So they wanted to have a big metric. They got the free downloads, but they didn't prove anything about their thesis. So the key thing is, if you're doing a beta, make sure it proves something. The question by early stage entrepreneurs often, are patents worth it? The answer, like many things, is it depends. Patents are only valuable if they can stop a competitor. And if you're doing something that Apple and Google want to do, they're going to do whatever they want anyway. So I often say, if there's a chance you're going to have corporate venture partners, patents will have the most value, because corporate venture partners are often not purely investing for economic terms. They're investing for value that what you are doing can add to their business in an eventual exit. So, and they're very expensive. So it's something at the early stage to be wary of. As earlier I mentioned, it's important to have good advisors. Some recommendations about getting good advisors: don't be afraid to push back, find yourself disagreeing with them, consider a change. The halo effect is very valuable if you get the right investors. Investors see you have a smart advisor with your credentials, they'll presume something good about your character and ideas. But the most important thing about finding an advisor is that they tell you hard stuff. You don't need more cheerleaders. You've got your friends, you've got your family, you've got your coworkers. I tell entrepreneurs I work with, I'm gonna be very tough on them. And you should always feel like you learned something or have work to do after chatting with your advisor. To be able to see everyone else, I didn't know if I needed to go into too much around the financing terms. Everyone knows there's three main kinds of financing: equity, convertible notes, and safes. I'm not gonna go into a lot of detail here because I actually wanna talk about something that doesn't get talked about a lot, which is the history of financing. And I think it's very important to understand the history of the financing models. Because what's going to happen is your lawyer and your entrepreneur friends are going to tell you to do a safe. And if you're successful, you're going to raise 50, 100, 200K with your safe. And then you're going to go pitch to a major angel network or some VCs that do early round financing. And they're going to tell you, if you don't switch to a cap note or to equity, they're not going to invest. And you're not going to understand the disconnect of why you think and why the media has told you everyone's doing a safe, that the professional investors won't take the safe. So I'm going to try to do this fast. Here's the scoop. For the longest time ever, up until quite recently, all investment was in the form of equity. Founders got common stock, employees got common stock, and all the investors got preferred stock. It was very easy. Cap tables were totally simple. There were no cap table implosions after all the conversion happened. And then people got clever. It would sometimes happen that there was a VC negotiating a round, but the VC wasn't ready to close it quite yet. They were going to close it in 2 or 3 months after some metrics were hit or something. But the founders, the company, still needed some cash to get to that closing. And so the bridge note was created. And the bridge note basically said, look, we'll give you some money now, but we're not going to spend a lot of time and effort pricing your company. The VC coming in 2 months has already spent all the time and effort doing it. We want to get in on that round. So give us a little bit of a discount off that price and we'll give you cash to get you through to that. And we'll convert at that price minus a little bit to compensate us for the risk. But the key part of the bridge note when it was originally created, was that price discovery was right around the corner. So you didn't have to do the price discovery now because it was going to happen in 2 or 3 months and you were getting compensated for that. And then somehow the word bridge disappeared and it just became a convertible note. And it started getting used as a standard form of financing. And the problem with it from the investor's perspective is that they're not in the lending business. They don't really want to be a lender and they don't want you to hold on to their note for 6 months or a year and then have it convert and you not have been compensated for all that time. Then the next thing that happened was that a woman named Carolyn Levy of Y Combinator in 2013 invented the safe. So even if you're an investor with debt, you have some protection. A safe is just a whispered promise behind a barn from the perspective of most investors. You don't even have the protections of having debt, and most major angel VC groups won't take it. One thing not to do if you're sticking with a safe, despite my strong advice here, is don't combine the words investor friendly with the word safe. I've been actually sitting with investors and entrepreneurs. I can think of some MIT entrepreneurs we were talking to a year ago, trying to sell us on what seemed like a great investment. They had the Marines all lined up to prototype their technology. And they were telling us how fantastically investor friendly they were. And then they were offering us an uncapped safe, which is pretty much the most useless investment vehicle imaginable. And we all just walked away. We couldn't imagine that they had a concept there of being investor friendly and offering us this uncapped safe. In terms of pitching, you need to always be networking. Once you go down this path, you need to join every possibly networking group. If you're not part of your alumni groups, join those. Get involved with angel groups. Find VCs that do seed or pre-seed. Warm leads if you read all the... tell you really quickly the narrative that's standard out there. You need to follow this narrative a little bit because this is how VCs compare deals. You're going to tell people something like, there's a big problem you've never heard of. We've got the solution. The market is really, really large. We're the team to do it. We need $1 million to hit a major inflection point. There's an identified marketplace for successful companies in our space. And that means a major exit for our investors. There's obviously a lot of variation on how that goes, but that's the standard narrative. As everyone is aware, the pitch deck is the standard medium for distributing the standard narrative. And you can't go off on a wild tangent with the deck. Investors are comparing deals and the deals have to sort of look the same. So you have to follow the standard deck narrative. One thing I've seen entrepreneurs do is every time they get negative feedback on their deck, they then go make a change. You're gonna get a lot of negative feedback. You may pitch 100, 150 times. Don't fall in the habit of making changes every single time. Obviously, if you see a lot of comments that are the same, you may need to go back to the drawing board, but don't be in the habit of constantly doubting what you've done. You may get advice that says, don't have an exit slide. I strongly recommend the exit slide for all the reasons I talked about. Most investors you talk to are not gonna be experts in your vertical, but you may be able to convince them that you have a great idea, that you understand the space and you're the team to do it, but they're not gonna understand the competitive landscape and they're not gonna understand that there's a marketplace for acquisition. You need to show them that marketplace exists. They're probably not gonna do that research on their own. The biggest goal of the pitch is to instill greed in your prospective investors. If you haven't created greed, you're probably not gonna get an investment. And the way to do this is to think about by putting yourself into their shoes and think about what they want to hear and what will sell. And be clear about these three things quickly. What's the problem? What's the solution? And how does it make the investor rich? That's how you make them greedy. I see this a lot in the Q&A session for pitches. You need to really work on having super pithy and super short answers. If you're spending 2 minutes answering a question, it just looks terrible. And in the private discussions the investors have afterwards, they're gonna be talking about how you didn't get the question, how you didn't have a clear answer, how you didn't know something. I've seen simple questions get asked like, and I've given an example, what's your customer positioning strategy? And your answer needs to be something super quick like paid advertising on Facebook and Google with a CAC of $75. You've just told the whole story. I've seen people take 2 minutes answering that question. It's not the way to go. This is a list of deal killers. The only thing I'll say here to move fast is never say you don't have competition. You always have competition, and don't get defensive. To move along fast, you're going to hear no a lot. You deserve a no fast. If you don't get a no fast from early stage investors, you need to move on, but you need to always ask for referrals. I tell my entrepreneurs to be investor friendly and do right by their investors, because if you're going to be a serial entrepreneur, you're going to want them in your pocket for future rounds. Always think about how to align interests with your investors and remove all friction to investing. And now I turn it over to Jeremy.
Okay, well, we'll have a angel investing 2.1. This is 101 to go into more depth, because this is a very good topic for everybody. And also, we'll invite them to, when we have practice pitching, we'll invite people with this kind of expertise to, you know, to help critique our members that are about to go on roadshows. So now let me turn it over to Jeremy. And Jeremy, if you need to take a little bit more time, please go ahead.
I'll try to be brief. I think Peter gave a lot of interesting thoughts that look at both sides of this, the table. Well, thank you both to DEF and Jed for inviting me to participate in this discussion today. Thanks to Peter for his initial presentation, which I found interesting. Always great to get insights from individuals like Peter. My background is a bit different, which I'll give a little bit of a color to here. So my name is Jeremy. I run an angel investors group in Washington, D.C. called New Dominion Angels, but it's not my day job. My day job is at the World Bank, where I work on private sector development projects focused on early stage finance at the World Bank. So essentially, I work in grassroots capitalism and try to find startup winners in the most difficult places in the world. So not in Silicon Valley, not in Boston, not in New York, but in places like Washington and the Middle East and the Caribbean and Africa. So my experience is a bit colored by that. So the thoughts that I hope to share today, or my impressions, really should help entrepreneurs who are thinking about raising money from angel investors. But I hope we have some prospective angel investors on the call who think it might be fun to give this a try. And so I hope for those folks that there's something of value here as well. Background on New Dominion, because I think when you're going out to raise money, say from an angel investors group, I'll give you a snapshot of what one of these groups might look like. We're essentially a membership club. We have about 55 members based throughout the Mid-Atlantic region, mostly in the Washington, D.C. area. So for a group like ours, we have a diverse membership base. It looks like some technologists, some software developers, but also some guys who run federal contracting companies. We have doctors, lawyers, a toilet paper salesman. We have a lot of diverse backgrounds in our group, which we think is a strength. Now, how we invest, mostly in the Mid-Atlantic, mostly in seed stage enterprise software startups. We have a disciplined, structured approach that really emphasizes collaboration and consensus building around deals, which is, again, part of this group process, which I'll go into a little bit. And when we invest, we all invest together. We set up a single purpose LLC. We usually invest about $250,000 in our initial investment, and we regularly participate in follow-on rounds. We're happy to either lead or co-invest with other investors. We actually generally prefer syndicating with other investors for a number of reasons I'll mention later. We've had 9 exits, but as Peter will attest to, an exit doesn't necessarily mean you made a lot of money. We have made money on some, but we've also received pennies on the dollars or zero when we've exited the company. And the idea today is to give you a sense, if you're thinking about investing, how you can try to avoid zeros. So I think for everybody on the call, it's really important to define what we mean by angel investors. Peter did a nice job kind of capturing the broad universe of early stage investors, ranging from friends, family, people you used to work with or you're connected with professionally, uncles, fools who want to get involved at the early stage. But when you look at a professional or people who want to be disciplined about angel investing, I think there are really three types of capital that everybody should keep in mind. One is human capital, right? This is the smarts, the business experience, the intellect that everybody who is investing hopefully brings to the table. You have the social capital, which is networks, relationships, connections that can be made. And then financial, which is the obvious part, the cash investment. And I always like to say, you know, what is the most important form of capital to the investor? I totally agree with Peter that we all want to make money and you've got to believe in the exit from the outset. But most angel investors have been successful business persons, and typically they can make more money. But what they're really sensitive about is their social capital. So do everything you can to avoid damaging somebody's reputation. Just to put angel investors into context within the seed stage investment community, I had a slide for this, but I didn't put it up. But 90% of what is considered seed stage capital in the US is invested by angel investors. So despite what people believe about venture capital, yes, it's a significant part of the startup journey. Yes, it's, you know, very important for technology companies that want to get big, but the majority of seed stage capital comes from angel investors. In the most recent data, imagine this, $24 billion invested through angel investors, friends and family, and $2.9 billion from VCs. Again, this was in the most recent year by deal data for seed stage startups. And then the other thing I would add is that angel investors are everywhere. So if you're an entrepreneur based in Washington, if you're an entrepreneur based in Ohio or Chicago or somewhere like Idaho, there are likely angel investors and you can find capital. Whereas largely venture capital is consolidated around significant cities like San Francisco and New York. When we look at angel investors, I have this from experience. What makes a good angel investor? Well, I think it's a few things. One is, I mentioned before, they have to have the capacity. So this is the capacity in terms of capital to be involved in angel investing, and they should bring value. They should look to add support to the startup. And they, you know, those are things that Peter really went into, but then I would add a couple of additional things. One is you want to make sure that you're engaging with people who are patient and have a long-term time horizon, because you're looking at potential business partners for 8 to 10 years. So you better get along well with them, and they better, you know, better trust you as good stewards to their investments. The other thing is they need to be risk tolerant. So they have to be willing and able to lose the money, or it can be a very painful experience for both parties. And then the last thing I would add here is, I mentioned this before when talking about the makeup of my angel investors group in Washington. You know, not all angel investors are cashed out tech unicorn founders. There are a lot of angel investors who can bring a lot of value from traditional industries. And so I see entrepreneurs who come to me and they'll ask me immediately, you know, are you strategic investors? And they have a very narrow perspective on what strategic investor means. They think it has to be somebody who went on a similar path that they are on with a software company that they raised venture capital and sold, but there are actually a lot more aspects to being a successful entrepreneur than just what is sort of the traditional belief. I look at four factors when it comes to sources of capital. So one is, what is motivating that capital? The second is, where's the capital coming from? The third is, how does that investor make money? And then the fourth is the time commitment to this. So for the purposes of today, let's just focus on two: source of funds, and then how money is made. I think it's really important to, you know, emphasize that friends and family and angel investors, they are investing their own money, their own hard-earned money. Venture capital funds are investing other people's money. They're limited partners. Now, that's not to say they're careless with it, but it certainly means that the emotions behind investing are different. The second thing is, how do they make money? Angel investors, Peter stressed it. There needs to be a significant liquidity event for an investor, for an angel investor, to make their money back. That is the only way that we can get our capital back and make money in this activity. For VC funds, they make money on management fees and, you know, carried interest, which is a form of capital gains, but the management fees can be significant and they can have nice lifestyles being investors of other people's money. And again, I think this goes to both some of the advice I would give to entrepreneurs, but which Peter gave about how you really connect with investors, particularly at the early stage. An angel investor is looking at a deal. I think Peter gave a lot of great insight into this, but I think it's also important to emphasize, you know, what is an experienced angel investor thinking when they are, you know, hearing a pitch from a startup? Yes, they need to believe in the dream from the outset, but they're going through a mental checklist of all the risks that they know on paper, like the ones listed here, in addition to the risks that come up in the conversation or from their previous experience as investors. And it's important because 50 to 70% of early stage investments fail to even return invested capital. And so that means that the winners need to win big to make up for it. So Peter went through some of the things that he looks at, and I'll skip this in the sake of time. We can come back in Q&A. So with so much risk, again, this is looking at the investors or the potential investors in the audience. How do you reduce it? How do you limit it? Well, the first thing you need to do is due diligence. This is some data, you know, data on angel investing is really hard to get because it's a sort of unstructured and sort of private activity, but the sort of very large study that was done looked at returns to angel group as a function of the amount of due diligence that they did. And of course, the level of due diligence is the single most important factor in having a successful outcome. So when you look at the chart here, the gray shows results when little due diligence was done. And by little due diligence, we mean 20 hours or less of due diligence. So, you know, you might think 15 hours is a lot, but in the scheme of things, it really isn't. The blue suggests more than 20 hours. And I think the median is 40 hours of due diligence. So if you were doing very little due diligence, the returns were about 1.1x. And many, you know, 65%, as I mentioned before, lose money for investors. For those where more than 20 hours of due diligence was done, those returns end up averaging 5.9x. And so when you look at this, it's really striking to me how often, and maybe Peter and I could have a discussion during the Q&A, there seems to be a heavy emphasis on, you know, being very entrepreneurial friendly and moving fast in due diligence. But, you know, I think there's a way to move quickly, but also be thorough. And I'm sure Peter's not suggesting a lack of thoroughness. I think it just comes down to how you approach investing, which I'll jump into. So my group, you know, we have a simple framework for looking at due diligence. We have to answer three questions, and obviously a long list of sub questions, but really it's, do I love this team? You've really got to believe in the team and believe that they are the team for this problem with this solution at this moment in time. We then look at whether or not we think this is a good business, and we look at all this sort of subcategory of factors below. And then if, and only if it's a good business, we look at whether or not it's a good investment. And this looks at things like, you know, IP and how defensible it might be, but also the terms of the investment and if there's a probable exit at the end. So I don't want to go into all the steps of due diligence, But when you ask how we look at due diligence or how we do due diligence at the early stage, it is very difficult. And it's quite complex, partly because we have so little data to work with. We can look at the product. We can try to find ways to convince ourselves that it works and that it does what it's supposed to do. But we're still dealing with a lot of unknowns. So we'll talk to customers if possible. We'll examine the competition. We'll look at your financial model. And I think one piece of advice for startups when they're preparing financials is, you know, when we look at the financial model, we're not looking at the top line to necessarily see how big it's going to get. We're looking at the assumptions behind the numbers and whether or not you've done the math in a way that is believable as inputs. And then, you know, finally, we want to spend time with the entrepreneur. So there is a bit of meeting with the team, talking to different founders one-on-one, and also allowing them to get familiar with us. So this takes a lot of time. And so if you're an individual angel investor, I believe it's very challenging to believe that you can commit the time and energy to this activity and to do it successfully. So I'll end with a few points on how I think you can improve your odds as an angel investor. I believe it's better as a team sport. And Peter mentioned, I believe he's part of New York Angels. He also set up a small fund. And so I'd be curious if he always invests as part of a group and with other investors, or if he does it on his own. And if he, when he first started as an investor, was he acting as a solo investor or as part of a group? But what does working as a group give to the investor? What does it offer? You'll find more and better deals because you've come together with a group of people who have their own networks, their own connections to different entrepreneurs, maybe relationships with other investors. And, you know, finding more better deals is critical to being successful, partly because you improve your odds dramatically if you build a portfolio. So portfolio approach is number two. And as I mentioned before, the level of due diligence, the workload can be shared amongst a lot of different members instead of, you know, being the burden of one or two individuals. And you can bring in a lot of different perspectives, whether it's industry, sector, technology, regulatory, you know, and then more functional expertise in say finance or marketing. Coming together as a team is a you know, very useful way to both share the workload and make sure you're covering all the unknowns. It also gives you better negotiating leverage if you're going in as a group. We often take board seats if we are the lead investor. We have pro rata rights, we have information rights, and some other benefits or some other advantages that come with quote unquote major investor status. And then the two last things here. One is larger capital pool to sustain the company over time. You know, you're never going to make, you know, rarely do you ever make one investment in a company if you're an angel investor. Typically, you invest with the intention to continue to fund the company forward. And despite what people like to believe is a sort of stair step, you know, very obvious, you know, expansion from family and friends to angel to VC to Series B to exit, there's a lot of in-between funding rounds and a lot of intermediate valleys of death where investors come in to plug those bridge financing gaps. So that, I had some other things that honest investors will tell you, but let's hold off on that, I think, and jump into some Q&A.
How do investors view companies who outsource most the work versus those companies who've raised enough capital to bring those services in-house? Does outsourcing everything hamper startup companies in the investors' eyes?
But I said that it can be a big issue since it represents additional risk. It's not super uncommon. Key thing is to address it head on with the investor community and find a way to de-risk it. So maybe your tech partner can have some equity. Maybe you have a CTO waiting in the wings and they're just waiting for you to close around so you can afford to pay them a living wage, whatever it is. Again, it's about reducing friction, not owning your IP or not having the intellectual capital of the company residing in the capital, right? And if your company is based upon technology, that's a lot of your intellectual capital. It's not ideal. So it's a risk and you have to de-risk it in some way.
We have another question, which is, go ahead, Jeremy, do you have a view on that?
I'm going to give the annoying answer of it depends. If you are a company that is developing really what you consider to be IP rich or IP heavy technology, and you are, licensing part of it or, outsourcing development to a third party, then, I see a lot of additional risk. There's a lot of possibility of technical debt that comes in later. And so, if it's more simple things like, you're using applications, we all expect that. But if it's, if your company is more focused on IP than execution, and maybe if you're in biosciences or pharma, that's the case. But if you're a software company, you could probably get by a little bit more if you really demonstrate that you're developing a strategy that you have executed before. Look, I think, different investors are, annoying and they have different personalities. And sometimes you feel it's abrasive, the due diligence. And if it doesn't feel like a fit, like if it's uncomfortable and you're finding yourself not liking the person, then yeah, that's probably actually more of a personality misfit than somebody who's being unreasonable. My group, it depends where we are in the investment round. If we are, coming in towards the end and there's another group that's in, say Peter was in with his group and they've already done due diligence, then we'll ride along on their due diligence and we'll try to close quickly. And we won't ask to have the same customer reference calls that Peter has had. If we're the first investors in and we're leading the round, I would say, if you're looking for a lead investor, you have to accept their process and their procedures. And a lot of times they're going to look for, it might take 2 to 3 months, even for a group like ours. And I don't think that's unreasonable if it's the first sort of organized investment capital.
Yeah, I'd agree that it always takes a lot longer than entrepreneurs expect for a sophisticated professional angel group to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And for us, it's the same thing. I mean, I'm doing due diligence right now on a water filtration technology. And I've spoken to customers, I've spoken to other investors, I've spoken to vendors, I've spoken to the principal investigator and chief scientists at the related university. We've read patent documents. It takes a long time. I think the good thing about, for an entrepreneur's perspective of working with an angel group like Jeremy's Angel Group or New York Angels, is that you get to pitch to a large audience. And there may be a numerous potentially interested angels, but what the angel group does is they'll assign a couple of deal leads, one or two deal leads, who will handle the due diligence. So instead of having 20 or 30 different potential investors calling your vendors, calling your customers, and really bugging the shit out of everyone, it's really one or two people handling all that. And really, it's a very investor-friendly way to manage the process. So the choice is to go to an angel group to get 20 investors or to go to 20 individual investors, you're way better off going to the angel group.
So it seems like also one key takeaway here is that due diligence is in a way another form of marketing and selling, and you're selling to customers, selling to investors. So if you look bad in terms of diligence, in terms of the relationship and not having your ducks in a row, not looking, being organized, it could hurt you. So companies should really think about making sure that you're ready for due diligence and that when somebody lifts up the hood to look inside, they're going to not have any friction, as Peter used that word, or negative energy.
And I think most bigger angel groups will have model documents available somewhere. So, you don't want to get caught not having all your ducks in a row and then be scrambling. You're going to be spending days answering due diligence stuff, redoing financial models, putting together product roadmaps that you didn't have in exactly the way the angels want to see them. So, before you pitch, take a look at their model documents or their model diligence requirements and make sure you're not, have huge gaps before you start going down the path.
Next question. What is the average percentage requested by angels for the 250K. And I can answer this one quickly. Just to, there's no percentage. The whole early on, you don't really know what it's going, what it's going to be converting into, that amount for convertible notes. You kind of have to wait till the next round to get a proper valuation. But I'll leave it. That's a high level. So
yeah, no, I'd love to offer a couple of thoughts on this. One is, you know, general starting point. I mean, there you can look at different people and their methodologies and their formulas. I kind of look at two rules of thumb. One is for each serious round of capital you're looking to raise. If you're a startup, very early stage, and you're raising $1 million, that to me is a serious round of capital. If you are raising a seed, you know, a true seed or a series A round, that might be $3 to $5 million. But every time you're looking to raise a significant amount of capital, you have to be willing to sell at least 15 up to 20 and 25% of your business. So when we invest $250,000, it's never, well, maybe once or twice it has been, but it's usually not the only capital going into the company. So that 250 might be part of a $1 million round, right? And so that company is probably selling anywhere between 15 to 25% of its business. One other thing I would add is, you know, I think entrepreneurs sometimes look at the wrong benchmarks. So if you are an entrepreneur in Washington, DC, or if you are an entrepreneur in Ohio, I'm from Ohio, that's why I keep referencing Ohio. Your cost of doing business, the cost of an engineer is much lower than in Silicon Valley. And the company should actually be priced according to the local market. So if I'm looking at companies in DC, I know from our years of experience working here, what a software company at the seed stage with, you know, a few marquee customers, I sort of know what the going price is, right? So a couple things, you know, is find the benchmarks and then find realistic formulas that could work for your company.
Thanks. This is from Whaley Fufano, who is a founder for a luxury cannabis company. When speaking about exit strategies, what is your ideal company? What if your ideal company is currently a competitor? Does it matter? So I'll leave that to Peter.
It happens all the time that big competitors acquire upstart companies. That may well be one of the prime ways companies get acquired. So it's not a problem.
Okay. Amanda Sweeney, if your startup has two founders and you aren't a legal entity yet, does an LLC or C Corp make a material difference from the perspective of an angel investor?
I mean, I see the question here. So certainly from a VC fund, they're pretty much always going to insist that you're a subchapter C corporation. And I think, you know, like for instance, our angel group, we would insist on that.
And Peter, why would you insist on that?
We're not going to have the same rights and be able to take advantage of the deal in the same way if it's not a C corp.
Yeah, can I
add? If you're a quality of life business and you just want to make some money, then an LLC is fine. If you're looking to raise capital, you're going to have to be a C corp.
Okay. Yeah, two other points to that. One is if you're just a couple co-founders operating an entity and you're losing money, an LLC is a good structure. But once you take on investors, yes, I mean, investors can write off the losses as a pass-through entity, but as Peter said, we want to make sure that the preferences and the conditions that we expect are in place from the outset, because I didn't mention this. We never have more power in the negotiations than we do during due diligence and negotiations. Once we send a check, you know, our influence in the company, we might have a board seat, but it's much diminished. The other thing is something called QSBS, which Jed can tell you about, which is qualified small business stock, which provides incredible tax advantages for holders, providing some conditions are met. So the advice there is when you're looking at deals, try to find and be aware of how you can sweeten the deal for investors. So tell them you know about QSBS. The other thing is research tax credits that your company might qualify for, which, you know, I know much more about tax credits in the DC area than I ever thought I would, but as an entrepreneur, definitely be aware of what exists and use them to entice investors.
And the QSBS actually was something I would have talked about if I had more time. It was in my notes to myself, but there's a 5-year clock that starts ticking. It's another reason why investors want equity right away, very first round, because, yeah, you know, not having to pay 20% capital gains turns a 4x return into a 5x return. And, you know, if your return was going to be $1 million, that's $200,000 you don't have to write to the government. So if you're going to give me a, if you're going to give an investor a convertible note and it doesn't convert for 2 years, and then you exit 3 years later, that's $200,000 under that scenario that the investor has to pay, that they wouldn't have to pay to the government if they started off as a stock deal.
Okay, great. We're going to wrap it up now. I really appreciate it. We'll have to do a second round of this because there's a lot of issues that are critical that we haven't explored. Just to wrap up on the last issue, just so it's clear to everybody, one thing they were talking about is qualified small business stock. And if you're a corporation, not an LLC, the first 10 million in capital gains, or I think it's 10 times basis. I'm not a tax person, but I think that's what it is. You don't get taxed on it, but you have to be in a certain field. Certain fields are excluded, I think, like restaurants. So that's a key thing that for all of the entrepreneurs on the call and also investors, you should really know. It's a massive, massive benefit to corporations, that tax break that people don't know about, like massive. If there's one of the few things to take away from today, it's that, especially if it's relevant for you. And somebody also just asked, what is a C-Corp and an LLC? C-Corp is a regular company that you expect with stock. And the LLC is a limited liability company. It's kind of a little bit like a partnership. And one difference between them is that in LLC, you can kind of create your own rules to a larger extent. And the tax treatment's different. So, we'll get into that in another Cornerstones. It's not that complex and it's very important, but we're running out of time here. And if anybody has a question, you can always contact one of us to ask for further information about corporation versus C Corp. But we'll handle that in another Cornerstones. That was very good. We really appreciate it. I already got good feedback from people. For Jeremy and Peter, thank you for your time. And thanks everybody for joining, and we'll see you at the next Cornerstones.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's deaf.org/join.